Let's get some mules, a replica 19th century wooden wagon, and relive the Oregon Trail today. Rivers, mountains, cliffs, runaway mules, cars and trucks, bad weather. What could possibly go wrong? Journalist Rinkerbach wanted to find out. He and his brother hitched a wagon to mules and set off to retrace what's left of the westward path traveled by thousands of 19th century pioneers. His new book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And Rinkerbach joins us now from Portland, Maine. Welcome.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here.
You write that when you decided to make this journey, your life was a little bit of a mess. Divorce, drinking, a little bit burnt out at your newspaper reporter job. I mean, was this adventure, Rinker, a bit of an escape or a shot at redemption on some level?
It was certainly a shot at redemption on a personal level, but I think there's something quintessentially American about it, too, to sort of bust out and do something significant. And, of course, in my case, it was also an opportunity to write about the history of the trail. So the book is sort of an amalgam of history and what happened to us.
There were really Oregon trails, plural, as you point out, I mean, with several different routes at key points. But in general, the trail followed key river valleys, and you guys tried to do the same, you and your brother Nick.
Yes, we stuck pretty much to the original ruts in most places, and the trail had to stay on the rivers for the pioneers to have water, navigation points, timber, and that sort of thing. So you pass from the Missouri River to the Platte River, big, beautiful, wide Platte River, crossing Nebraska, then up through Wyoming, the Sweetwater, which is just absolutely one of the most gorgeous pieces of landscape in the world, and so forth onto the legendary Snake in Idaho. So it was just wonderful to have this experience that was so simple. You just stay on the river, and if you can't see the river, climb high and find the river. And it was that simplicity of purpose that was so magical about the trip.
And you write about the mixture of, you know, hardship and exhilaration. Can you read a little bit about that?
Sure. This was a place where we'd made a lot of progress, and I realized that if we had no catastrophes, we might actually make it to Oregon. But I was also beginning to realize the more arduous it became, the more stressed I was, the more exhilarated I felt. So I'll just read you this section, sure. There were other miseries of the trail. 5 days would go by when neither Nick nor I had taken a shower, and a filthy residue of dust, axle grease, mule hair, and hayseeds covered everything in the wagon, including the plates we ate on every night. Coleman lanterns and flashlights, jostled by the constant bumping of the wagon, refused to work. So we started just living sun up to sundown without any artificial light. Before harnessing, we had to chase mules every morning. Our backs ached from sitting on a hard wooden seat for 8 or 10 hours every day, holding back mules. But we adored the simplicity of life out there and pushing hard every day toward our 20-mile goal. The fragrances of the wildflower fields sedated me, and when my brother called the mules, I felt that I was living a stanza out of Walt Whitman.
Your brother Nick is your partner in this, and he becomes kind of a central character in this journey. He's a carpenter from Maine, but that doesn't capture his unique skill sets. I mean, he can fix just about anything. He knows mules and horses. It was almost like he was born in the 1800s.
Yeah, one of my sisters says that Nick was born out of century. We would have problems with the harness where it was rubbing the mules. Nick would pull out some used leather that we had and repair the harness. He's also really, really great. I call him one of the great team drivers of his generation, and he is. And so when we got to these very rough parts where it was very perilous to get the wagon up and down the mountains, Nick was great at the driving.
Yet you guys are very different. I mean, he's this pragmatic Mainer, and you're trying to bring along your bocce set and your shoeshine kit. Tell us about that.
Well, my Brooks Brothers bathrobe, too. Come on, Eric. I mean, that was really important stuff. I mean, what happened was I was going to be living out of a 12-foot by 38-inch box with a canvas cover over it for the next 4 months, and everything I needed for life had to be in that wagon. The very next morning, the second day, I wake up, and after moving this stuff in and out of the wagon just for one 24-hour period, I said, deep six this stuff. Get rid of it, you know. I brought my Brooks Brothers bathrobe. I brought, Eric, I mean, if you got out on the trail, wouldn't you need a pasta steamer? The trip was an adventure in discovering myself relative to my brother and how many foibles you bring along from your old life that you realize when you're on a covered wagon trip crossing the entire Oregon Trail, you don't need.
I mean, in this age of selfies and smartphones, it seems like you saw this journey as a way to unplug and slow things down.
Yeah, we got out there, and first of all, there wasn't cell phone coverage for probably half of the trail because it's very remote areas, Wyoming and so forth. Our form of artificial light we carried, flashlights, Coleman lanterns, whatever, broke. GPS I used for about 2 weeks of early in the trip, and then I said, Rinker, you're moving at 4 miles an hour here. You can probably see where you have to go. And so I ditched that baby, and it was just one technology-free day after another, and believe me, America, just take that smartphone and throw it in the river. You don't need it.
Journalist Rinker Buck, his new book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Eric.
Let's get some mules, a replica 19th century wooden wagon, and relive the Oregon Trail today. Rivers, mountains, cliffs, runaway mules, cars and trucks, bad weather. What could possibly go wrong? Journalist Rinker Buck wanted to find out. He and his brother hitched a wagon to mules and set off to retrace what's left of the westward path traveled by thousands of 19th century pioneers. His new book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And Rinker Buck joins us now from Portland, Maine. Welcome.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here.
You write that when you decided to make this journey, your life was a little bit of a mess. Divorce, drinking, a little bit burnt out at your newspaper reporter job. I mean, was this adventure, Rinker, a bit of an escape or a shot at redemption on some level?
It was certainly a shot at redemption on a personal level, but I think there's something quintessentially American about it, too, to sort of bust out and do something significant. And, of course, in my case, it was also an opportunity to write about the history of the trail. So the book is sort of an amalgam of history and what happened to us.
There were really Oregon trails, plural, as you point out, I mean, with several different routes at key points. But in general, the trail followed key river valleys, and you guys tried to do the same, you and your brother Nick.
Yes, we stuck pretty much to the original ruts in most places, and the trail had to stay on the rivers for the pioneers to have water, navigation points, timber, and that sort of thing. So you pass from the Missouri River to the Platte River, big, beautiful, wide Platte River, crossing Nebraska, then up through Wyoming, the Sweetwater, which is just absolutely one of the most gorgeous pieces of landscape in the world, and so forth onto the legendary Snake in Idaho. So it was just wonderful to have this experience that was so simple. You just stay on the river, and if you can't see the river, climb high and find the river. And it was that simplicity of purpose that was so magical about the trip.
And you write about the mixture of, you know, hardship and exhilaration. Can you read a little bit about that?
Sure. This was a place where we'd made a lot of progress, and I realized that if we had no catastrophes, we might actually make it to Oregon. But I was also beginning to realize the more arduous it became, the more stressed I was, the more exhilarated I felt. So I'll just read you this section, sure. There were other miseries of the trail. 5 days would go by when neither Nick nor I had taken a shower, and a filthy residue of dust, axle grease, mule hair, and hayseeds covered everything in the wagon, including the plates we ate on every night. Coleman lanterns and flashlights, jostled by the constant bumping of the wagon, refused to work. So we started just living sun up to sundown without any artificial light. Before harnessing, we had to chase mules every morning. Our backs ached from sitting on a hard wooden seat for 8 or 10 hours every day, holding back mules. But we adored the simplicity of life out there and pushing hard every day toward our 20-mile goal. The fragrances of the wildflower fields sedated me, and when my brother called the mules, I felt that I was living a stanza out of Walt Whitman.
Your brother Nick is your partner in this, and he becomes kind of a central character in this journey. He's a carpenter from Maine, but that doesn't capture his unique skill sets. I mean, he can fix just about anything. He knows mules and horses. It was almost like he was born in the 1800s.
Yeah, one of my sisters says that Nick was born out of century. We would have problems with the harness where it was rubbing the mules. Nick would pull out some used leather that we had and repair the harness. He's also really, really great. I call him one of the great team drivers of his generation, and he is. And so when we got to these very rough parts where it was very perilous to get the wagon up and down the mountains, Nick was great at the driving.
Yet you guys are very different. I mean, he's this pragmatic Mainer, and you're trying to bring along your bocce set and your shoeshine kit. Tell us about that.
Well, my Brooks Brothers bathrobe, too. Come on, Eric. I mean, that was really important stuff. I mean, what happened was I was going to be living out of a 12-foot by 38-inch box with a canvas cover over it for the next 4 months, and everything I needed for life had to be in that wagon. The very next morning, the second day, I wake up, and after moving this stuff in and out of the wagon just for one 24-hour period, I said, deep six this stuff. Get rid of it, you know. I brought my Brooks Brothers bathrobe. I brought, Eric, I mean, if you got out on the trail, wouldn't you need a pasta steamer? The trip was an adventure in discovering myself relative to my brother and how many foibles you bring along from your old life that you realize when you're on a covered wagon trip crossing the entire Oregon Trail you don't need.
I mean, in this age of selfies and smartphones, it seems like you saw this journey as a way to unplug and slow things down.
Yeah, we got out there, and first of all, there wasn't cell phone coverage for probably half of the trail because it's very remote areas, Wyoming and so forth. Our form of artificial light we carried, flashlights, Coleman lanterns, whatever, broke. GPS I used for about 2 weeks of early in the trip, and then I said, Rinker, you're moving at 4 miles an hour here. You can probably see where you have to go. And so I ditched that baby, and it was just one technology-free day after another. And believe me, America, just take that smartphone and throw it in the river. You don't need it.
Journalist Rinker Buck, his new book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Eric.
One of the early pioneers of this technology, Geoffrey Hinton, known as one of the so-called godfathers of AI. Hinton worked at Google for over a decade in deep learning technology and earlier this year won the Nobel Prize for Physics. So Sajid began the interview by asking him how it felt to win that historic prize.
It felt very strange. To begin with, I thought it was a prank because I'm not a physicist.
Did you think it was something that AI dreamt up?
No, I didn't think it was AI. I thought it was someone playing a prank. But they had a strong Swedish accent, so I fairly soon came to realise that this was real.
I wonder if you thought when you started this work, this is where we would be now.
I didn't think it would be where we would be now. I thought at some point in the future we would get here, because the situation we're in now is that most of the experts in the field think that sometime within probably the next 20 years, we're going to develop AIs that are smarter than people. And that's a very scary thought.
Well, I'd read somewhere, I know this is a really simple way to put it, that, you know, humans are something like, I don't know, 10,000 times plus smarter than the goldfish. And ASI, artificial superintelligence, could be 10,000 times more intelligent than a human. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
It's not clear what times means in that context. I like to think of it as imagine yourself and a three-year-old. We'll be the three-year-olds and they'll be the grown-ups.
Do you think people, sort of society generally, realize the profound change that's coming? You know, I've referred to the change AI will bring on par with the sort of creation of the wheel or the discovery of the fire. Do you think it could go that far?
Oh yes. I think it's like the Industrial Revolution. In the Industrial Revolution, human strength ceased to be that relevant because machines were just stronger. And if you wanted to dig a ditch, you dug it with the machine. What we've got now is something that's replacing human intelligence. And just ordinary human intelligence will not be at the cutting edge anymore. It'll be machines.
What do you think life might be like then in say 10 to 20 years from now?
It'll depend very much on what our political systems do with this technology. So my big worry at present is that we're in a situation now where we need to be very careful and very thoughtful about developing a potentially very dangerous technology. It's going to have lots of wonderful effects in healthcare and in almost every industry. It's going to make things more efficient. But we need to be very careful about the development of it. We need regulations to stop people using it for bad things. And we don't appear to have those kinds of political systems in place at present.
Yeah, you know, speaking myself also as a former government minister, and especially as a former Chancellor of the Exchequer, I'm interested also to know about how you think this might change existing structures. You know, so for example, you know, you have talked about many people losing their jobs, you know, as obviously happened with the Industrial Revolution, and what that means for society and the types of jobs that might be lost. And that's what I might call, when I talk about the bad, I mean, that's the kind of thing, it's a sort of a necessary outcome of technological change. But how profound do you think that will be?
Well, if you want to know what happened in the Industrial Revolution to ordinary people, I think reading Dickens is good. I think Dickens characterized quite a lot of what happened to ordinary people there. There'll be similar amounts of change caused by AI. And my worry is that even though it'll cause huge increases in productivity, which should be good for society, it may end up being very bad for society if all the benefit goes to the rich and a lot of people lose their jobs and become poorer. If you have a big gap between rich and poor, it's very bad for society.
Yeah. What's different this time?
So these things are more intelligent than us. So there was never any chance in the Industrial Revolution that machines would take over from people just because they were stronger. We were still in control because we had the intelligence. Now there's the threat that these things can take control. So that's one big difference.
And I think perhaps also it's the pace of change now as well. It's very profound as well. The actual pace we're seeing, how quickly this is all happening.
Yes, it's very, very fast. Much faster than I expected. Because it's so fast, we haven't had time to do the research needed on how to keep it under control.
Okay, and let's just talk, because I'd be interested in your views on this and some of the good things that are already emerging from AI. For example, as a former health secretary, I think a lot about the advances that can be made in medical research and life sciences. Is that a sector you'd sort of pick and say that actually is something where, you know, we can really extend healthy life years for people, we can all live longer and have happy and healthy lives?
Yes. So I think it's going to do tremendous good in areas like medicine. And that's why it's unrealistic to talk about stopping the progress. It's unrealistic to say, this stuff could be very dangerous, let's stop developing it. I didn't sign a petition that asked for that a few years ago, because it just seemed completely unrealistic to me. In healthcare, for example, in a few years' time, we'll be able to have family doctors who, in effect, have seen 100 million patients and know all the tests ever done on you and on your relatives. 200,000 people about die every year from bad diagnoses. Most of that's going to go away. Already, an AI system is better than a doctor at doing diagnoses. And the combination of the AI system and the doctor is much better than the doctor at dealing with difficult cases. And the AI system's only going to get better.
In the past, you previously predicted, I think you said there's a 10% chance that AI will lead to human extinction within the next 3 decades. Has anything changed your analysis of that?
Not really. I think 10 to 20.
Oh, you're going up.
If anything. You see, we've never had to deal with things more intelligent than ourselves before. And how many examples do you know of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing? There are very few examples.
Very few.
There's a mother and baby. Evolution put a lot of work into allowing the baby to control the mother. But that's about the only example I know of.
Perhaps then just to end on that, despite what you just said, I remain an optimist about AI and what it means. Am I right to feel that way?
I hope you're right to feel that way. My worry is that the invisible hand is not going to keep us safe. So just leaving it to the profit motive of large companies is not going to be sufficient to make sure they develop it safely. And you can see that if you look at the history of OpenAI. Initially, they were very concerned with safety. And as time went by and the potential profits got bigger, they got less and less concerned with safety. The only thing that can force those big companies to do more research on safety is government regulation.
It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion, Jeffrey. And there's a lot of food for thought there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today on this program.
Thank you.
This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry went to three scientists, David Baker, John Jumper, and Demis Hassabis, for their groundbreaking work using artificial intelligence to advance biomedical and protein research. The AI model they developed, called AlphaFold, uses databases with hundreds of thousands of protein structures and millions of protein sequences to predict and even design protein structures, speeding up a months or years-long process to mere hours or even minutes. AlphaFold was rolled out just 4 years ago and has since been cited in scientific studies more than 20,000 times. Joining us now from London is Demis Hassabis, co-founder and CEO of Google DeepMind and recipient of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Demis, congratulations and welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So first and foremost, what did you think when you heard the news?
Well, I was totally stunned, to be honest, and it still hasn't really sunk in even now, 24 hours later. So it just feels very surreal.
So I'm going to try here in simplest terms, which is not simple at all, but to condense the work you and your colleagues have done. Basically, you and your colleague John Jumper discovered new and powerful ways to not only decode but also design proteins using artificial intelligence. I'm not even going to try to understand the details of your work, but in terms of application, how could this impact future development of things like medicine and vaccines? What does it mean?
Well, proteins are the kind of building blocks of life, really. So everything, all the functions of that own your body are kind of supported by proteins. And it's really important to understand their structure, their 3D structure, so that you can understand what the function is they have. And so that's what AlphaFold, our program, does. It predicts that 3D structure just from the genetic sequence. And it's going to be really important for things like drug discovery and understanding disease.
There's one scientist who reacted to the news of your award by calling your work the Holy Grail in terms of what it's been able to do. Do you agree with that characterization?
Well, it's very nice of them to say so. I mean, it's certainly a grand challenge. I mean, the reason it kind of caught my attention is it's been a kind of grand challenge of biology for the last 50 years. So people have been predicting since the 70s that this should be possible, but until now, no one has been able to do it to an accuracy high enough that it's useful for biologists and medical experts.
So just in your background, you co-founded DeepMind back in 2010. But before that, I was interested to read you designed video games. Before that, you were a chess prodigy. You were once even ranked the second highest player in the world under the age of 14. How did those endeavors, chess and gaming, feed into this work today?
Well, there's a connection all the way through my career, even though I've done different things. So it's because of gaming and chess specifically that I got started to think about thinking. And I was trying to improve my own thought processes, as you do when you're playing chess for, you know, the junior teams and the national junior teams and things like that. And I was playing it very professionally. And part of that training, you also use chess computers, very early chess computers in the 80s. They were actually physical blocks of plastic that you had to press the keys on. And I was sort of intrigued by the fact that someone had programmed this, you know, inanimate object to actually play chess and play chess well. And that's what got me into AI. So and then I studied neuroscience as well as computer science, tried to understand better how our own brains work and how intelligence is produced and the mechanisms behind it. And then finally, that all comes together with the work we've been doing on AI.
As you well know, one of your fellow laureates this year is a man named Geoffrey Hinton, who's often called the godfather of AI. He resigned from Google last year, and he's really been sounding the alarm on what he says are the potential dangers here, that, as he puts it, he worries that the overall consequences of this might be systems that are more intelligent than us that might eventually take control. Do you share that concern?
You know, I've known Jeff, we've been colleagues for many, many years, and he's a fantastic scientist. And, you know, I think that my view is sort of more moderate than that. I feel like, of course, I work my whole life on AI because I think it's going to be unbelievably beneficial to humanity and to society. You know, AlphaFold is just, I think, the first expression of that. And, you know, I think we can go on next to try and cure many terrible diseases. I think it can help with climate crisis, new materials, new energy sources, new mathematics. I think AI is going to accelerate scientific discovery and medical discovery across the board. So those are just some of the benefits I think AI is going to bring and why I've worked my whole life on AI. So it's going to be this hugely transformative technology. But as with any new powerful technology, and perhaps AI will be the most powerful, that comes with risks, attendant risks as well, and unknowns. And some of those are to do with controllability, understanding these systems, interpreting what they do, and how to manage the, you know, what are the values we want these systems to have? What do we want to use them for? How do we want to deploy them? And some of these questions are technical in nature, technical challenges, and others are more societal and need discussion with the whole of society, civil society, academia, as well as the tech companies and industrial labs, and also government. And I've been encouraging all of those debates to happen. And it's great that it's starting to see those things happen. And I think given enough time and effort, we will solve these challenges. I'm a big believer in human ingenuity. But we need to start discussing and researching those things now.
That is Demis Hassabis, co-founder and CEO of Google DeepMind and recipient of this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Demis, thank you and congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Next, NASA says its Voyager 1 probe, the most distant human-made object in the universe, is sending usable information to Earth again after months of spouting gibberish. The spaceship left the solar system in 2012 and is currently more than 15 billion miles from Earth. Well, Dr. Jennifer Millard is an astronomer at Fifth Star Labs, joining us from Barry in Wales. Thank you very much for coming on the programme.
Yeah, very happy to. I'm glad it's good news.
It is good news. So talk us through, first of all, I suppose, what was going wrong?
So this all began way back in November when, as you say, the craft just wasn't sending back anything that we could unravel back on Earth. It was all nonsense. And it seems to be a hardware problem. One of the chips on board and part of the flight data subsystem, so one of the computers on board, has broken. And, you know, it's not surprising for something that's 4.5 decades old and has been operating for nearly 3.5 decades longer than it should have. So it means that the code that was in this chip wasn't working properly. And so now this code has been transferred to different chips on board. And so now we can start getting some sensible data back from this probe. At the minute, it's just engineering and health data, but soon they're going to put some more software around and we should get lovely science data back.
There's so much to go through there. That is an incredible thing. Firstly, this process of basically repairing something so far away, in kind of simple terms, talk us through how did they do this repair?
Exactly. So it's not a physical repair. Of course, you know, we can't get to the probe and swap out the old chip and put a new chip in. So we've had to kind of be a little bit clever. NASA have had to, instead of using this particular part of the microchip, part of the computer to operate the commands that operate the software, they're using different parts of the chip in order to use that software. They've essentially kind of turned this little bit of the chip off, ignore that little bit of the computer and use different parts of the computer instead.
OK, right. Now let's get a bit more on what on Earth it is sending back. What kind of information is it beaming all the way back to Earth?
So at the minute, it's what we call health and engineering data. So it's, you know, is everything else working? Is the probe where we think it is in space? Is it pointing in the right direction? Things like that. It's no science data yet, but they're confident that all of the instruments are still working. It's just a case now that we need different software to go onto different parts of the chip in order to access that science data again. So they're going to repeat the process. It's going to take some time because it takes an awful long time to talk to Voyager. It takes 22 and a half hours to send a message and then 22 and a half hours to get one back. But soon then we should be getting some lovely science data.
Interesting. And where's it going?
Well, it's just going out into our galaxy, towards the heart of our galaxy. It's just sailing now in the space between the stars. And this is why we want Voyager to keep on going. So Voyager 1 and, of course, Voyager 2. It's probing the space between the stars. No other craft have been able to do this. And it's going to be many decades before we get another craft to have a look at what's going on beyond the sun's influence.
And you've already mentioned it's going on 40 plus years or whatever, a lot longer than it was ever supposed to. How long can it keep going?
It all depends how much power is left on board. So they're powered by radioactive decay, the Voyager probes. And over time, there's just less and less of that fuel on board. At the minute, the expectations are at least into next year, but soon there's just not going to be enough power to run the science instruments. And eventually they will fall quiet. But their mission won't end there because on board they have golden disks. And there are notes in 55 different languages, greetings in 55 different languages, sounds of Earth. There are images as well. And they'll just continue to sail around our galaxy. And who knows, maybe some advanced civilization will one day bump into our probes and they'll get a little glimpse of life on Earth.
It's absolutely extraordinary. Thank you so much for coming on the programme and talking us through it. Jennifer Millar, Jolchen Vowell, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Next, NASA says its Voyager 1 probe, the most distant human-made object in the universe, is sending usable information to Earth again after months of spouting gibberish. The spaceship left the solar system in 2012 and is currently more than 15 billion miles from Earth. Well, Dr. Jennifer Millard is an astronomer at Fifth Star Labs, joining us from Barry in Wales. Thank you very much for coming on the programme.
Yeah, very happy to. I'm glad it's good news.
It is good news. So talk us through, first of all, I suppose, what was going wrong?
So this all began way back in November when, as you say, the craft just wasn't sending back anything that we could unravel back on Earth. It was all nonsense. And it seems to be a hardware problem. One of the chips on board and part of the flight data subsystem, so one of the computers on board, has broken. And, you know, it's not surprising for something that's 4.5 decades old and has been operating for nearly 3.5 decades longer than it should have. So it means that the code that was in this chip wasn't working properly. And so now this code has been transferred to different chips on board. And so now we can start getting some sensible data back from this probe. At the minute, it's just engineering and health data, but soon right. They're going to move some more software around and we should get lovely science data back.
There's so much to go through there. That is an incredible thing. Firstly, this process of basically repairing something so far away, in kind of simple terms, talk us through how did they do this repair?
Exactly. So it's not a physical repair, of course. You know, we can't get to the probe and swap out the old chip and put a new chip in. So we've had to kind of be a little bit clever. NASA have had to, instead of using this particular part of the microchip, part of the computer to operate the commands that operate the software, they're using different parts of the chip in order to use that software. They've essentially kind of turned this little bit of the chip off, ignore that little bit of the computer, and use different parts of the computer instead.
Okay, right. Now let's get a bit more on what on earth it is sending back. What kind of information is it beaming all the way back to Earth?
So at the minute, it's what we call health and engineering data. So it's, you know, is everything else working? Is the probe where we think it is in space? Is it pointing in the right direction? Things like that. It's no science data yet, but they're confident that all of the instruments are still working. It's just a case now that we need different software to go onto different parts of the chip in order to access that science data again. So they're going to repeat the process. It's going to take some time because it takes an awful long time to talk to Voyager. It takes 22 and a half hours to send a message and then 22 and a half hours to get one back. But soon then we should be getting some lovely science data.
Interesting. And where's it going?
Well, it's just going out into our galaxy, towards the heart of our galaxy. It is just sailing now in the space between the stars. And this is why we want Voyager to keep on going. So Voyager 1 and, of course, Voyager 2. It's probing the space between the stars. No other craft have been able to do this. And it's going to be many decades before we get another craft to have a look at what's going on beyond the sun's influence.
And you've already mentioned it's going on 40 plus years or whatever, a lot longer than it was ever supposed to. How long can it keep going?
It all depends how much power is left on board. So they're powered by radioactive decay, the Voyager probes. And over time, there's just less and less of that fuel on board. At the minute, the expectations are at least into next year, but soon there's just not going to be enough power to run the science instruments, and eventually they will fall quiet. But their mission won't end there, because on board they have golden discs, and there are notes in 55 different languages, greetings in 55 different languages, sounds of Earth, there are images as well, and they'll just continue to sail around our galaxy, and who knows, maybe some advanced civilization will one day bump into our probes and they'll get a little glimpse of life on Earth.
It's absolutely extraordinary. Thank you so much for coming on the programme and talking us through it. Jennifer Millar-Jolkenvaal, thank you.
Thanks for having me.